regional trade is the answer for the betterment of the citizens of the two countries.
Now, Dr. Dawood, to wrap this up, I wanted you to summarize your visit to Iran, this visit to Iran, and the achievements that you've had up to now.
I would classify it as a remarkable visit. Remarkable because I see a change in the Iranian government. I've met your ministers of trade, agriculture, road and transport, and I've met officials of the petroleum ministry, and there is a distinct change, and I know that there is a change in Pakistan too. So that was one thing that is good. As soon as we talked about all the issues, it did not take long for both sides, to put whatever their grievances were. I said, let's put the grievances, looking at each other as brothers, put our grievances down, and have a frank discussion. And it didn't take long that we started to change and made a very short list that this has to be changed. So that was the second point on which I feel. Third was I went and saw your car manufacturing facility. What I saw today was very, very pleasing. A remarkable achievement by the Iranian people. A very good facility. And it shows the strength of your engineering. It showed the strength of your manufacturing. And I would like to very much have collaboration between Pakistani manufacturers and Iran. You see, we talked of trade and investment. Bulk of our discussions was on trade. On investment, which is falling behind, we've got to be able to have greater investment between the two countries. From what I saw today, and if that is the level of your engineering, then you must have a certain standard in your chemicals and your plastic industry and your food processing industry. Your government mentioned that they would like to come into Pakistan and invest in auto industry, home appliances, and dairy. I said, you're most welcome. We would love to have an Iranian investment, and I will certainly facilitate that investment in these three sectors.
Dr. Dawood, thank you for your time. I hope your visit to Iran was fruitful, and I wish you all the best.
It's been a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to coming again.
And that was our episode on Iran and Pakistan moving towards bolstering their bilateral trade ties, which have for years been affected by U.S. sanctions. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
In the limelight.
The U.S. government is begging the British High Court to allow Julian Assange to be extradited to the United States. Doing so would be a human rights disaster, given that American prisons violate the most basic human rights of political prisoners like Assange. In this regard, We have prepared an article for you written by Chip Gibbons, writer. This article is published under the heading, Julian Assange's extradition to the United States would result in serious human rights violations. Stay tuned for more. For 2 days, British prosecutors, acting on behalf of their U.S. counterparts, urged the U.K. High Court to overturn a judge's decision blocking Julian Assange's extradition to the United States. Although the United States indictment against Assange is a textbook example of a political offense, which are traditionally immune from extradition, the judge rejected Assange's press freedom claims. Instead, she found that given the conditions of U.S. prisons and Assange's mental state, his extradition would place the journalist at risk of suicide. In seeking to rebut this ruling, the U.S. and U.K. prosecutors' sadism was on full display. British prosecutors engaged in character assassination of an eminent psychiatrist who they themselves have used as an expert and implied Assange could not be suicidal or severely mentally ill as he regularly watched television in the afternoon. The proceedings also turned on the validity of U.S. assurances that Assange would receive humane treatment in U.S. prisons. Not only are these assurances filed with troubling holes, but even the highest standard of treatment, as outlined by the United States for Assange, would likely amount to torture. This is hardly surprising given how the United States has treated whistleblowers and others accused of giving information to the media in prison. Given the United States' miserable track record in treating political prisoners like Assange, and prisoners more generally, it's clear that a successful extradition of Assange to the United States would result in grievous violations of human rights. Much of the United States' assurances deal with the potential for Assange to be subject to special administrative measures, that is, SAMS, or be placed in the administrative maximum facility in Florence, Colorado, that is, ADX Florence, a supermax prison, two prospects that alarmed a UK district judge so much that she blocked extradition. The Center for Constitutional Rights has described SAMS as the darkest corner of the U.S. federal prison system, combining the brutality and isolation of maximum security units with additional restrictions that deny individuals almost any connection to the human world. SAMS include both physical and social isolation. Prisoners subjected to SAMS are already in solitary confinement. SAMS forbid prisoners from communicating at all with other prisoners. Only approved family members and lawyers may speak to someone under a SAM, and these calls are monitored by the FBI. A successful extradition of Assange to the United States would result in grievous violations of the human rights. The SAMs apply not only to the prisoner, but impose gag orders on those that are approved to speak with them, including lawyers. Prisoners subject to SAMs are restricted in what information they can receive from the outside world, with prison officials being allowed to censor periodicals about current events. SAMs are reserved for national security and terrorism cases. Assange has stated he thinks he may be subject to them. Joshua Scott, the accused source for WikiLeaks' Vault 7 revelations, has been subject to SAM since October 2018. Scott maintains he's not the Vault 7 source and told officials that whoever was should be executed. In March 2020, a jury failed to reach a verdict on the Espionage Act charges against him. The government is seeking to retry Sukut, and he remains in jail, subject to SAMs, in solitary confinement, and not allowed to go outside after over 3 years. The United States has not guaranteed Assange will not be subject to SAMs. Instead, they have assured that Assange would only be subject to SAMs if, after he was extradited to the United States, he committed an action that warranted imposing them. This is hardly reassuring. The discretion to impose SAMs rests with the Attorney General, and the way Attorneys General have imposed SAMs is arbitrary, without any due process. SAMs cut off not only defendants but their attorneys from communicating with the media, a long-time goal of the United States and others when it comes to Assange. In blocking extradition, the district judge decided that if convicted, Assange would likely be sent to ADX Florence. In this prison, inmates are confined to their cells for 23 hours a day. In the 8-by-12-foot cells, everything, including the furniture, is made of concrete. Like with the SAMs, the United States has offered assurances about ADX Florence that are full of holes. The United States assures Assange would not be held there unless after entry of this assurance, Assange was to commit any future act that then meant he met the test for such designation. While the assurances are hardly reassuring, what is equally troubling is Assange's fate, even if the assurances are kept. In a declaration to British courts, Assistant U.S. Attorney Gordon Cromberg asserted that if Assange is brought to the United States and subjected to pretrial detention, he will most likely be held at the William G. Trousdale Alexandria Adult Detention Center in Alexandria, Virginia. Cromberg claimed there is no solitary confinement at the Alexandria Detention Center before he described in detail the jail's protective custody and administrative segregation housing units. Inmates in protective custody are not allowed to interact with other inmates. Inmates in administrative segregation, according to Cromberg declaration, are kept in their cells 22 hours a day. British prosecutors rejected the claims that holding a person by themselves in a cell for 22 hours a day constituted solitary confinement. To make this point, they drew on Cromberg's statements that inmates in administrative segregation are able to speak to one other through the doors and windows of their cells, and that inmates in administrative segregation can meet with lawyers. The United States claims, as parroted by British prosecutors, that Assange would not face solitary confinement are patently absurd. The United Nations Standard Minimum Rules for the Treatment of Prisoners define solitary confinement as 22 hours or more a day without meaningful human contact. Under the Mandela Rule, solitary confinement in excess of 15 consecutive days constitutes prolonged solitary confinement. Two successive UN special rapporteurs on torture have stressed that prolonged solitary confinement violates international human rights law and can very likely amount to torture. This is especially the case when inflicted on prisoners like Assange with pre-existing mental health problems. The United States' own description of administrative segregation offered to the UK government meets the standard for solitary confinement under international law, given that Assange is almost certainly likely to spend more than 15 days in jail awaiting trial. Assange's treatment under the United States' own assurances would constitute torture under international law. And Assange would not be the first person charged under the Espionage Act to be held in Alexandria Detention Center, meaning we already have a glimpse at the cruelties that await him. At least three whistleblowers have been held at Alexandria Detention Center. It is where Chelsea Manning was held when she refused to testify before the WikiLeaks grand jury. Similar to Cronberg's declaration, Manning's jailers claim she was not in solitary confinement, which does exist at their facility, but administrative segregation. Manning was kept alone in her cell for over 22 hours a day and was only allowed to leave between the hours of 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. Although Manning was removed from solitary after public pressure, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture still found the U.S. government had tortured her. This was the second time a UN Special Rapporteur on Torture had made such a finding. In 2012, when Chelsea Manning was court-martialed for giving WikiLeaks the documents at the heart of the Assange indictment, her pretrial detention in a military jail was found to be constituted cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and torture. CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling described his own time at the Alexandria Detention Center in harrowing detail. Sterling recalled being placed in a holding cell with numerous other detainees. "We were packed in like so much garbage, sleeping on the floor and having to use an open toilet before being moved to a special cell block that also housed Zacharias Mosini, convicted of involvement in 9/11 attacks." According to Sterling, his time in this unit was in solitary confinement and he would spend days on end without being let out of cell. Drone whistleblower Daniel Hale was also recently imprisoned at the Alexandria Detention Center. After pleading guilty to one account of violating the Espionage Act, Hale was initially released on his own recognizance. But after a therapist reported Hale as suicidal, Hale was ordered taken into custody, allegedly for his own mental health. Such a move is perverse on numerous levels. As Hale's attorney, Jesslyn Raddock, told Jacobin, Daniel's initial time at the Alexandria Detention Center was tantamount to torture. After being sentenced, a judge recommended Hale be sent to a federal medical facility. First, Hale was transferred to Northern Neck Regional Jail, where he was housed in a room with 100 other inmates. When he was placed in federal custody, Hale was sent to the United States Penitentiary, Marion, in a communications management unit, that is CMU.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked and
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by the late Ayatollah Agha Mujtaba Tahrani.
تو که حسابگری، تو که سوداگری، فهمیدی حواست جمع باشه.
You Muslim brothers who are precise in your counting of divine rewards, you especially must pay attention a lot. Let me mention something important here. People in cases like reciting a dua, a supplication, or praying must have a sense of selflessness. Now, what does this mean? It means that egocentrism and self-centeredness ruins me and you. But selflessness will save us all. Escaping our egocentrism will open the ways to us and solve our problems.
در این سنخ معارف ما دارد این مسائل رو چکار میکنه به ما میاموزه درست یا نه برای دیگری دا.
When in Islam we are recommended to recite a dua for our believing sister or our believing brother, we are at the same time trained to do good actions for others. In fact, we do one dua for others, but we will be rewarded in a multiplied manner. Don't stick only to praying for yourself, and think about others too. If you let go of yourself, then you will reach Allah instead. At this point, you will be granted everything you want, leave egocentrism, and attain godliness.
از خودیت رها شو و به خداییت بپیوند.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, where we listen to a speech by Ayatollah Agha Mujtaba Tehrani. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Oh, 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 oh,
Salam everybody. For your information, the holy city of Qom in Iran is indeed the foremost center of diffusion of true Islamic knowledge, with students from all over the world coming to acquire the bezels of wisdom. Here is what the Prophet's 16th fallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, has said regarding the city, which is blessed by the holy shrine of his granddaughter, Hazrat Fatima Ma'sume, peace upon her. Indeed, God has a sanctuary, and that is Mecca. The messenger of God, Prophet Muhammad, has a sanctuary, and that is Medina. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, has a sanctuary, and that is Kufa in Iraq. And we, the Ahlul Bayt, have a sanctuary, and that is Qom.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The United Arab Emirates. a modern country in the deserts of the Persian Gulf. With four-lane orbital motorways, expensive cars, towering skyscrapers, posh hotels, state-of-the-art shopping centers, and all other aspects of modernity except for one, human rights, even in its basic form. For years, Emirati political activists have been devoutly after this holy grail, endangering their lives and the lives of their family members.
الحادث الحدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
On the fifth day of November this year, a tragic death in the UAE grabbed the headlines. Mohammed Al Nuaimi, the son of the self-exiled Emirati political dissident Ahmed Al Nuaimi, who was suffering from cerebral palsy, passed away in a hospital in Sharjah. His family, now living in London, didn't dare to come back to the UAE for dear life. The plight of the Al-Nuaimis dates back to March 2011, in the heat of the widespread protests in the Arab world. Back then, 132 activists, including Ahmed Al-Nuaimi, signed a petition calling for increased political participation and constitutional reforms in the UAE. Soon after, many of them were arrested and tried in a case that became known as the UAE 94. At that point, Al Nuaimi was in the UK on a business trip. Fearing arrest, he decided not to return to the homeland.
There's a great pressure that's being placed on dissidents, if that may be the term used. These dissidents that you talk about are, you know, generally people who do not agree with the form of policies that are meted out by the government. They have a right to express their voices, any speeches and protests. But I believe it's extremely important for anybody to, you know, voice out their concerns.
In 2013, Al Nuaimi was sentenced in absentia to 15 years in prison, and his family were put under a travel ban. In the following years, almost all his family managed to escape the country through a land border and join Al Nuaimi. Mohammed, however, couldn't make it due to his health condition and disability. And despite pressure from rights groups, the Emirati authorities never allowed him to reunite with his family, a desperate act in reprisal for his father's activism.
Well, definitely there's two faces to UAE. And they're following the footsteps of their masters, the Saudi regime. And we all know all those who have been working as human rights activists are very well aware that, you know, they have double standards. There's a standard that they provide for the West in which they, you know, they succumb to everything that, you know, happily that the Western media would highlight. And what they have been doing is that for such a long time is that they've been hiding behind this mask that they wear, and it seems that they have no conscience when it comes to, you know, even a child such as Mohammed or Nuaimi.
Earlier this year, the political dissident launched an online campaign using the hashtag Mohammed Baniya, my son Mohammed, calling for Abu Dhabi to lift the travel ban on his paralyzed son after 9 years because he needed specialist care, but the government refused to budge.
I think obviously, it's a way of silencing any dissent. Instead of people who have a particular political view being exiled or silenced, their voice or their views or opinions are silenced by threats and restrictions or to their family, as in this case, which really is collective targeting and collective punishment of people for differences of opinion and political views.
Mohammed's death triggered a wave of international condemnation. MENA Rights Group, for example, tweeted, "Another example of the cruelty of the UAE regime and of the suffering caused by travel bans." Mohammed last saw his family when he was 18, but was never allowed to leave the country. His parents and 5 siblings live in exile and could not say goodbye. Rest in peace, Mohammed.
It's double standards all across the board, especially with the UAE. Any place you go to Saudi, and that's the same thing. There's, you know, this whole thing about pleasing the West and antagonizing its own people has been going on for many, many years. It's not something that's just come across now. But yes, I can see that there is a huge amount of double standards being placed through UAE, and it will be about pleasing their masters in the West.
The fact is, Abu Dhabi has long been targeting the relatives of rights activists and political dissidents. According to We Record, an international human rights platform, the Emirati state has targeted the families of activists and human rights defenders through various measures, including the revocation of nationality, denial of travel, and the reunification of families.
Well, I think what I hear, there are travel restrictions and bans on other people, particularly those who have some differences of opinion or politics with the ruling regime or for other reasons.
Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department, which is ironically on friendly terms with the UAE, has released a hard-hitting report on human rights practices in the country. According to the report, the government revoked the citizenship of 19 relatives of 2 dissidents, banned 30 relatives of 6 dissidents from traveling, and barred 22 relatives of 3 dissidents from renewing their identity documents. In all cases, authorities allegedly cited state security reasons.
You can't use WhatsApp in these countries. Access to internet is restricted in the Emirates in particular. Even non-harmful websites with political news or views, you're not able to access them from inside the Emirates. The Emirates also has banned as a broad definition of terrorism, which extends to lots of non-violent political groups, and even charities as well that they disagree with.
The fact is that attempts by the UAE security apparatus to pressure the relatives of political dissidents residing abroad have reached an alarming level. Without renewed passports and identity cards, they're deprived of their most basic rights to basic services. Many of them can no longer work, study, access health services, or even a driver's license. The case of the Al-Nuaimis is just a tiny fraction of what the Emirati authorities commit against those who think differently. A graphic example of injustice and collective punishment running deep beneath the modern veneer of the United Arab Emirates.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, dear brothers and sisters in faith and humanity, Salamu Alaikum. So welcome to this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. Our topic for today is We All Make Mistakes. Today, Monday, is the 9th of Rabiul Thani, 1443 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 24th of Aban, 1400 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 15th of November, 2021 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. This is Chapter and Fall. We choose for you to listen, verse 29.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. يا أيها الذين آمنوا إن تتقوا الله يجعل لكم فرقانا ويكفر عنكم سيئاتكم ويغفر لكم والله ذو الفضل العظيم.
O you who have believed, if you fear Allah, He will grant you a criterion and will remove from you your misdeeds and forgive you. And Allah is the possessor of great bounty.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Fakhr Razi has explained the expiation of sins is concealment in this world, while forgiveness is a deliverance from the punishment of Allah in hereafter. According to the statements of some other commentators of the Quran, expiation is to wipe out the social and psychological effects of sins, while forgiveness is a remittance in respect to hell. Therefore, those who put aside the mental desires will recognize the truth, and their piety causes a proper insight to come forth in them and a great virtue and reward to be obtained.
IRIB English Radio. Recitation as well as translation of Quran.
وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا مُوسَى الْكِتَابَ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَهْتَدُونَ.
And we certainly gave Moses the scripture, that perhaps they would be guided.
Short commentary of the Quran. Islamic issues.
Institution of the family in Islam is the most beloved by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
The life of the infallible. All in all, in today's special, IRIB English Radio.
We are talking about our mistakes. We all make mistakes. Mistakes happen. We all make them. It is part of what makes us human. How you react and respond to mistakes is something that shows your character. It is common for many of us to instantly begin to beat ourselves up over our mistakes, fixating on the lack of perfectionism. But is this truly a great or even healthy way to react to making a mistake? rather than looking at mistakes as a strictly negative thing. Look at them as opportunities. What these opportunities are ultimately up to you, but they are endless. So the next time you make a mistake, catch yourself before you start down the long road of what ifs, the extreme self-criticism. Instead, try to remember the gifts that mistakes bring you and what you can do to become the best version of yourself from this mistake. You are not your mistakes, but you are what you do with them. You have the power to change the way you view mistakes and chances of them happening again. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wa bi nasta'in. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with how to take lessons from our own mistakes. Many people may be afraid of making any mistake. Because of this, being afraid of one's own mistakes in order not to reach so that he or she wouldn't reach the desired effect or the desired situation or context or case might prevent him or her from making any effort. While the correct situation, while the correct decision is that we should continue our life, we should continue doing our best in order to live successfully in our community. Hence, we are expected and not to be afraid of making mistakes. Rather, we have to take lessons from our own mistakes, and we have to find out, okay, why and in what context and in what capacity we made a mistake. For example, suppose that a student goes to school and in his exam, he makes some mistakes. Usually, the mark he gets from his teacher isn't what he had expected. There may be two ways, there may be at least two options for this student. The first one is, not to go to school or not to take any exam. Another one is that, the student should learn, where he made the mistakes and what the correct answers must be.
Talking about mistakes, it's good to look at how Prophet Muhammad corrected mistakes. Be gentle. The Prophet of Islam, Muhammad al-Mustafa, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him and his family, extremely perceptive toward the people around him. He knew when someone was sensitive and vulnerable, and he often approached mistakes with utmost gentleness. Once a Bedouin entered the Prophet's mosque for the first time, he raised his voice in supplication. "O Allah, forgive me and Muhammad, but don't forgive anyone else." The Prophet smiled at him and remarked gently, "You're limiting something that is vast." So deep was the empathy the Prophet had for his people that he did everything possible to make things easy for them. He removed every obstacle that stood between the people and Allah's forgiveness, and he searched out solutions to individuals' unique circumstances. يا إلهي خذ بقلبي للرشاد At this time of today's special, let's look at the benefits of making mistakes. Yes, benefits of making mistakes. Mistakes allow us to make amends. When we make a mistake and it impacts the lives of others, whatever in a small or more significant way, we have a chance to make amends, to explain and to apologize. The opportunity to get to know each other better, to deepen our understanding and cement our connections. Mistakes bring us closer together. Being honest about our own mistakes can increase our empathy and compassion. Appreciating that mistakes are inevitable and that we ourselves have made many can shape our response when we witness the mistakes of others. Rather than judging, insulting, and blaming them, we can be kind and gentle.
We human beings are all sinners. It's part of our nature. Allah Azza wa Jal created human beings, and we're not infallible. We're not sinless. We're sinful, except the ma'sumi, except those who are infallible. The prophets and the imams, they don't commit sins. But everyone else, all other human beings, are sinful. They commit sins. Whether there are some that commit big sins, there are some that commit small sins. There are some that commit both big sins and small sins. At the end of the day, we are all sinful. We all carry sins on our shoulders. We've disobeyed Allah Azza wa Jal. We've done things that Allah has asked us not to. Each person has a weak spot. For some, it's money. For some, it's alcohol. For some, it's lust. For some, it's gambling. For some, it's power. They'll do anything to reach power. For some, it's all about money. They'll do anything to get money, to win money. They're willing to fool people, trick people, break laws, laws of the land, laws of God, and so on and so forth. We all have our weak points and spots. Some, for some of us, our weak points is our tongue. We pray, we fast, we give our khums, we go to Hajj and Umrah and Ziyarah, but we cannot control our tongues. We don't steal, we don't cheat, we don't gamble, we don't drink, but ghibah is our weak point. Ghibah is our weak spot. Our tongue, we cannot control our tongues. We backbite against people. We mention them in ways that we shouldn't. So we all commit sins. We've all have committed sins that we shouldn't have. But luckily, Allah Azza wa Jal has opened the door of repentance. The door of repentance is always open. Some people, if you do them wrong, they might forgive you once. Some people don't forgive whatsoever. If you wrong them, they'll never forgive you. They don't give second chances. There's some people, they'll give you one more chance. One more chance. There's some people, they'll give you two chances. You do them wrong once, they'll forgive. A second time, they'll forgive. But the third time, they'll stop speaking to you. They'll lose your trust, their trust in you. That friendship is over. There's people that give a couple of chances, but then they'll lose their patience, and they'll say enough is enough, and they'll cut their ties off with you. Allah Azza wa Jal gives us a first chance, and a second, and a third, and a tenth, and a 20th, and a 30th. Allah always keeps His door open. Allah always gives another chance, and another chance, and another chance.
That was all for today's special. Thank you very much for joining us, inshallah. We meet you in another episode of today's special. Until then, we'll leave you in Allah's protection.
I don't wanna run anymore. Forgive me, Lord, don't close your door. I promise I surrender. I'm giving you my heart and my soul.
I've been thinking about my past. I wanna say I found you, Lord, at last. I just wanna tell you that I really love you. I know you'll always be by my side.
Astaghfirullah.
Forgive me, O Lord.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRI.